All right, joining me now on the Super 70 Sports Hotline, the number two scorer in the history of the American Basketball Association, Basketball Hall of Famer Dan Issel. Dan, how are you?
I'm great, Ricky. How are you doing?
Doing very well today. You know, such a thrill to have you on the podcast. You were a big part of my youth as a basketball fan. I was born in 1971 in Horse Cave, Kentucky, and I think one of my frustrations growing up was feeling like I just missed out on Kentucky having a professional basketball team. And you, of course, were a larger-than-life figure in the state of Kentucky in the history of basketball, going back to your days playing for Adolph Rupp.
Yeah, it was really a special time. Of course, I tell people I was blessed to play 25 years of organized basketball, and my four favorite years were the years I was at UK, because it might have grown some in popularity, but not much. It was really the center of attention in the state of Kentucky, even way back when. And then, of course, getting to stay in Kentucky and playing 5 years with the Kentucky Colonels in the ABA. You know, as time passes, Ricky, you forget the bad things and only remember the good things. But there were a lot of good things about the ABA and about playing in that league. And, of course, winning the championship in 1975 in Louisville was it's still the biggest thrill of my basketball career.
Well, let's go back to those days at the University of Kentucky to start out this conversation. You are, of course, the all-time leading scorer in the history of the University of Kentucky basketball program. And given the way that guys go pro early now, that may be a record that stands for a very long time, Dan.
You know, I'm surprised that it has stood for as long as it has. I mean, I graduated in 1970, so that was a long, long time ago. And for the players not to be able to break that record, I think you're right. And of course, I had the single game record till a few years ago, and Jody Meeks had an unbelievable game at Tennessee and broke the individual record. But you're absolutely right, the way that it's set up today, and I don't see it changing. I mean, at some point, you know, maybe they'll make the kids stay in college for 2 years. But with all of the talented kids leaving early to go to the pros, it might stand a while longer.
What do you think about that, the early entries? I feel like even when I was a kid, and I was really coming of age as a basketball fan in the late 70s and early 80s, you got to know the players. They were there for a while. I mean, of course, in your days, freshmen weren't eligible. But when I was growing up, I mean, I saw guys like Ralph Sampson play 4 years of college ball. You felt like you got to know the players a little bit. There was some continuity.
Right.
It seems like the college game has lost something because of that.
Well, I hate the rule because, as I just said, you know, my 4 years at Kentucky were my four favorite years. Now, I understand a lot of the guys today, you know, aren't as financially well off as they could be, and that's a lot of money we're talking about. And so to go to the pros and be able to take care of your family, and I understand that, but I wish that the kids had a chance to experience 4 years of college. Now, maybe I was just lucky and not every place has that, but I remember distinctly trying to talk Rex Chapman out of leaving early. I've known Rex since he was a little boy. I played with his dad Wayne at the Colonels my first year, and you know, Rex was 6-7 years old running around the court in the locker room. But I tried to talk him out of leaving. I said, you know, you stay here, you'll be the all-time leading scorer, and and the fans will love you. And you know, I'm sure they still do love him, but it would have been real special had he stayed the 4 years. And I wish they changed the rule, but they're not going to change it anytime soon, that's for sure.
Well, tell me about Rupp, because Adolph Rupp, of course, was an institution in the state of Kentucky. 41 years, I think, as the head coach from the early 30s through the early 70s. And I know that he was, you know, very near the end of his career during the time that you were there. I believe he coached a couple more seasons after you were gone, two or three. What were your impressions of Rupp as a coach and as a man?
Scared to death. he was a strict disciplinarian. We could not talk during practice, if you can imagine that. Can you imagine the kids today telling them you can't say a word from the time practice starts until it's over? I mean, all you heard at our practices was the squeak of the tennis shoes, the bouncing of the ball, and Coach Rupp's voice. And But I was very fortunate. If my relationship with Coach Rupp had ended with my graduation, I might not feel the way I do. But I was very fortunate. You're absolutely right. He coached two more years after I graduated. And then we had a basketball camp together. And then for a few years, Coach Rupp was connected with the Kentucky Colonel organization. And I got to know Coach Rupp outside of the game of basketball, and he was at that point he was a very generous man. You know, he was tough on the outside, but he was I really got to know him and got to love him after my playing career was over. But he was a taskmaster, that's for sure.
Well, one more thing I have to ask you, and I'm itching to get to the ABA, but you know, one of the guys that you squared off with throughout your collegiate career, and I believe you always came out on the winning end, but certainly not without Pete Maravich putting up some spirited efforts against you guys. And of course, anybody who is aware of Pistol Pete's college career knows that he averaged over 44 points a game. And for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, I didn't misspeak. He averaged over 44 points a game for LSU for the entirety of his career. What was it like going up against Pistol Pete and those LSU teams that you guys overall had a little bit outgunned, but Maravich was, you know, really something?
Yeah, Pete was terrific. Now, Ricky, you talk about records that'll never be broken. How about some of those scoring records? I tell people, my senior year at Kentucky, I was the second leading scorer in the nation, and I only lost the scoring title by 10 points.
So close.
Per game. Oh. 10 points per game. He averaged 44, and I averaged 34, so those records certainly will never be broken. But you're absolutely right. And you know, when I used to have a chance to talk to younger people who remembered Pete and knew of Pete, that's exactly what I used as a barometer of how important team play is in the game of basketball. A lot of coaches in the SEC would try to devise ways to stop Pete. They do a box and one or a triangle and two. But Pete was so clever with the basketball. He's not the best shooter I've ever seen, far from it. But as far as handling the basketball, passing the basketball, you could run all five guys at him, and he would be able to get an open shot. A lot of SEC coaches tried to devise these ways to stop Pete, and you couldn't do it. And Coach Rupp's philosophy was, hey, we're going to play him straight up. We're going to guard him one-on-one, and we're just going to make sure the other four guys don't beat us. And in the six games that we played head-to-head, because we were contemporaries, same year, in the six games we played head-to-head, Pete averaged 52 points a game. And they never came closer than 9 points to beating us. And so he was phenomenal. He was the best ball handler and passer I've ever seen.
Well, I'll tell you, I was looking at a box score earlier this afternoon in anticipation of speaking with you, and it was February 21st, 1970, in Baton Rouge. Maravich goes for 64 against you guys, and I'm pretty sure you'll remember this game because you yourself countered with 51 and 17 rebounds as you guys won. But, I mean, what an incredible duel that was.
And I'll tell you, of course, you know, back then they didn't have all these sports channels or ESPN or anything like that. If you were on TV nationwide, it was on a regular network. And the year before that game that you just referenced, Lou Alcindor, of course, Kareem, played against Houston and Elvin Hayes in the Astrodome, and that was that game was carried on more stations across the country than any college basketball game had ever been. And that game that you just talked about broke that record. That game was shown on more channels across the country than any college basketball game up until that point.
No kidding. I did not realize that.
Yep.
Well, if you're going to score 51 and grab 17 rebounds, you pick the day to do it, Dan.
Well, as long as we won the game, that was the most important thing.
Well, and going into your ABA career, one of the things that strikes me so much about your career is I mean, you played on winning teams consistently throughout your career, certainly in the ABA, and I know that many of my listeners are old enough to well know this, and some may not be. The Kentucky Colonels were a very proud franchise, really a cornerstone franchise in the American Basketball Association, and every year that you were there, you guys were highly competitive and in the mix come playoff time. For you coming out of college, obviously you would have been a high pick in the NBA if that had been the direction that you had indicated that you wanted to go, but you opted to sign with the Colonels and go to this really fledgling league that I believe at that point in time had been around for three seasons prior to your graduation. Can you kind of take me through the decision-making process when you're obviously a coveted player, two-time All-American coming out of college ball and trying to decide what you're going to do with your professional life?
Well, starting from the very beginning, I got a call from the Dallas Chaparrals, who a year later would become the San Antonio Spurs. And I got a call from the Dallas Chaparrals, or my representative did, and they said, we've drafted Dan in the APA draft. And my representative said, well, I can tell you this. The only team that Dan will even consider playing for in the ABA is the Kentucky Colonels. And remarkably, about a week later, the Kentucky Colonels called and said they had my draft right. So that's how I wound up being drafted. It was really a pretty easy decision, Ricky. Again, my representatives talked to you know, some of the teams that had the higher picks in the NBA draft, and the money was pretty comparable, but the important thing was, you know, I got to stay in the state of Kentucky. I fell in love with Kentucky when I went to school there, and I married a girl from Lexington, and the fact that I could stay in the state and play professional basketball, and you know, you referenced earlier that I'm the second leading scorer in the history of the ABA. We've got to give the leading scorer a little credit, my good buddy Louis Dampier. And of course, Louis being in Louisville and being with the Colonels also helped in that decision. But when we found out that the money was going to be about the same, it really was an easy decision. And you know what? I have never regretted it. Not only did I enjoy my ABA days, and as you said, we had some great teams. We only won one championship, but we might have had the best team in the ABA 3 or 4 years that I was there. But you know, that made the decision pretty easy, and I'm not so sure at that point I would have been ready to play center in the NBA, and so it was a great opportunity for me to grow up. And the amazing thing about that team, Ricky, is there were four Naismith Basketball Hall of Famers on that team: Artis Gilmore, Louis Dampier, and Coach Hubie Brown. And for one organization, one team at the same time, to have four Basketball Hall of Famers, I think is just remarkable.
Absolutely. And you mentioned Artis Gilmore. Of course, your rookie year, you led the ABA in scoring, and you guys went 44-40, which is certainly respectable, but that 71-72 season, looking at the team's record, you guys went 68-16 with yourself and Artis Gilmore, you know, doing some incredible work down low. That team didn't win the championship. I don't even believe that you guys went to the finals that year. But
we didn't.
But what an unbelievable team that was. I mean, you win 68 games in any league, and that's impressive stuff.
Well, the amazing thing is that we did go my rookie year when we were 44-40. That team just got better and better as the year went along, and we did go to the finals of the ABA that year and lost to the Utah Stars in seven games in the ABA championship.
Zelmo Beatty.
Zelmo Beatty, Willie Wise, Ron Boone, and that was a great series, and they won the seventh game in Salt Lake City. But you're right. We 68-16. I think everybody was shocked when that team didn't win the ABA, and we got knocked off early. I remember we were playing the Nets, and they basically double teamed Artis every time he caught the ball, and double teamed me every time I caught the ball, and double teamed Louie, and had the other players try to beat us. But that's what I said. We only won one championship, but we probably had the best team 3 or 4 years that we were there.
Yeah, I mean, the following year you guys went 7 with the Pacers and got beat on your home floor in the deciding game. And of course, 2 years later, you guys took care of the Pacers and won it all. That 74-75 team, Hubie Brown has been very clear through the years that when people talk about the differences in competition level between the NBA and the ABA, he's always been unequivocal that that's the greatest team that he ever coached, and he would basically have put you guys up against anyone.
Yeah, and Hubie was the reason we finally got over the hump. I mean, we had some great teams, but really didn't understand, I don't think, what it took. And Hubie's first year there was that 74-75 year, and we just we wound up winning the last 10 regular season games and just blitzed through the playoffs. We won all three playoff series 4-1. So we wound up winning 22 out of our last 25 basketball games. So That was an unbelievable year, and Hubie deserves a lot of credit for that.
How do you answer that question in terms of the level of play between the two leagues? Because I know that in those days, occasionally there would be some talk of having a sort of a challenge series between the ABA champions and the NBA champions, and that talk was always coming from the ABA towards the NBA, and it never happened. But you guys did play a number of preseason games through the years against NBA teams. How did you assess the relative level of competition during those years?
Well, here's how I answer that. The first 2 years after the merger, the Denver Nuggets won the Midwest Division. The first All-Star game after the merger, half of the starters were former ABA players. So, I'm sure I would get an argument from a lot of people. But I would say the last 3 or 4 years of the ABA, we were just as competitive as the NBA. The year we won the ABA championship, the Golden State Warriors won the NBA championship, and we did challenge them to a series. And, of course, it's understandable why the NBA would refuse. I mean, that they had everything to lose and nothing to gain. But the reason, Ricky, that we were able to be, in my mind, as good as the NBA was, the NBA still had a rule that you could not join an NBA club till your college class graduated. Now, it didn't matter if you went to college or not. Even if you didn't go to college, you had to wait 4 years until you could play in the NBA. And, of course, the ABA, started taking, they would have taken an eighth grader if you could play. And so we got people like George McGinnis and Doc and George Gervin, and you can just go on and on and on. Spencer Haywood. The ABA was getting some incredible talent because they were taking these players early, and the NBA wouldn't.
That's a really great point. And do you think that the reason that the NBA was kind of slow to move in that direction, was it arrogance? Because the impression that I've always gotten from what I've read about the two leagues during that time is that the NBA had a little bit of a superiority complex, if you will.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, you've heard comments from NBA people. Well, the ball they play with belongs on a seal's nose, not on a basketball court. But I find it interesting that it didn't take the NBA too long after the merger to adopt the 3-point line. So, there were a lot of things we did in the NBA. In fact, Bob Nedelicki, who was a really great competitor of mine that played for the Indiana Pacers, Bob just sent me a T-shirt the other day, and it's got an ABA ball on it. And it says, "We changed the game," and I love that T-shirt. I'm not going to wear it. I'm gonna frame it or something, because the ABA really did change the game. Not only is that where the 3-point shot came from, but prior to the ABA, the NBA was a disaster to watch. I mean, teams walked the ball up and down the court and crammed it inside to the big guys. As late as the early 70s, the NBA championship series was shown after the late news. It was on tape. The championship series was on tape delay. Yeah. We really did change the game, because the 3-point line opened the game up. Teams would get up and down and there was a lot of scoring that went on, which the fans love. So, I don't let anybody tell me in those days the NBA was better than the ABA.
What did you think about the red, white, and blue ball initially? I mean, I think for myself, and probably for many other fans, it's so visually striking. We loved it, particularly as a kid. Who doesn't love the colorful red, white, and blue ball? But what was it like for a player who obviously you've grown up your entire life using a traditional basketball, and now they hand you this thing?
Yeah, amazingly, I would say the first couple of days of practice, you know, you would notice the difference. And but amazingly, it took a very short time before it was just a basketball. And you know, I never did think that that. In fact, I thought because of the rotating panels, it was really kind of a teaching tool. I mean, you could tell right on your release if you were getting the proper release and the proper backspin because of the different colored panels. So, you know, it really didn't make that much difference.
Was there any degree, and as you've already noted, that it's not as though the NBA was anything approaching what it is today in terms of media coverage. It was a different world back then. But relative to the NBA, you guys were kind of toiling in relative anonymity. Was that something that bothered the players to any degree, that maybe the feats and accomplishments that you guys were making weren't really being recognized on a national scale?
Yeah, and you know, it that was the fact that they didn't include the NBA didn't include any of the ABA stats or didn't include any of those years as far as your retirement. But there was a rumor, Ricky, every week that we were about to get a national contract for television. There was a rumor every week that the merger was going to happen. But we played in smaller markets. I mean, you know, we had, there was a team in LA for about a minute and a half, and there was a team on Long Island. But, you know, we had teams in North Carolina and in Virginia and Louisville and Indianapolis, for that matter, weren't that big, those big markets then. So, you know, you're right. Anonymity is a great word, but I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Well, let's go to that last season, before the merger, when things sort of reached a critical mass for the league. Now, prior to the beginning of that season, and we've talked about your connections to Kentucky, 3 years starring varsity ball with the University of Kentucky, and then 6 years, five years with the Colonels, and you get essentially sold to the Baltimore Claws. And I know that I definitely know that I have some listeners who are thinking the Baltimore Who's, and I understand that, because the Claws ultimately disbanded after 3 preseason games, and perhaps there are some of you out there who aren't aware that the Hall of Famer Dan Issel is a proud former member of the Baltimore Claws, but you are.
I'll tell you what, you're impressing me, Ricky, with the homework that you've done. Because we never got that national TV contract, teams by then, is 73, 74, 75, began to fall by the wayside because, you know, it just wasn't financially feasible. And the ABA was doing everything that they could possibly do to keep the league alive. The team in Memphis was basically given to a couple of guys in Baltimore who promised that they would keep the league going. And, you know, John Y, even though we won the championship in 75, John Y. Brown, who was the owner, he and his wife Ellie, lost money, and it made sense to him to sell either Artis or myself, because we were the the two players that would have brought the most money. And so I was sold to this team that had been given to Baltimore. And my attorney, after I've really blanked those 10 days out of my life. I tell myself I went straight from Kentucky to Denver. But my attorney, after it was all over, my attorney wrote the sports editor of the Baltimore Sun asking for a picture of me in a Baltimore Claw uniform. And as you said, They lasted three exhibition games. They didn't even have practice gear that had Baltimore on it. We were still using the old practice gear that said Memphis when we were practicing in Baltimore. And so he wrote the editor, sports editor of the Baltimore Sun, for asking for this picture. And the sports editor wrote back this great letter saying, I have researched your request and have so far have been unable to find that any such picture was ever taken. He said, in fact, trying to locate somebody connected with the Baltimore Claws is like trying to locate last evening's thunderstorm, which I thought that was a great line. But again, everything worked out for the best because I wound up in Denver basically because John Y had sold me to Baltimore and never received a payment. And so the Denver Nuggets had drafted Marvin Webster, number one that year, a 7-foot center, and he came down with hepatitis. And so he called Denver, and Denver said, "Sure, we'll buy you." So and so the money actually went right from Denver to John Y. Brown, and then teams continued to fold so that by the All-Star game that last year, there were only seven ABA teams left. And the All-Star game was here in Denver. And we had the best record in the ABA. So the Denver Nuggets that last year of the ABA played the All-Star team from the other six teams in the ABA. And of course that All-Star game is famous because another thing that had never happened before happened in the ABA with the slam dunk contest.
Now,
and that was the first ever slam dunk contest.
And that was really, in many respects, that was the father of what we know now as NBA All-Star Weekend. It was an extravaganza. I mean, particularly compared to anything that had ever been seen before. I mean, it's I'm sure what they do now is even more of an extravaganza. But at that time in 1976, just having a slam dunk contest was sort of revolutionary.
Absolutely. And we had a concert. I think Glenn Campbell put on a concert the night before the All-Star game, and we had the slam dunk contest. And you're exactly right. It was the forerunner of what we have today as far as the All-Star Game weekend.
What are your recollections of that slam dunk contest? Because I actually had your old Denver teammate Gus Girard on the podcast some while back, and Gus was talking to me about how the players just lined up and were as awestruck by Dr. J as the fans were.
Yeah, I mean, we'd never seen it. It was the first slam dunk contest ever, and they had judges, and of course, the two favorites were David Thompson and Julius. And I remember Julius walking off steps from the free throw line down to the other free throw line, and here he came running. And took off from the free throw line. He was actually 3 or 4 inches inside, but the arena was packed, and Julius runs the length of the court, takes off from the free throw line, dunks the basketball, and the whole place went up for grabs. I mean, it was obvious the slam dunk contest was over at that point.
Well, you mentioned David Thompson, who, of course, was the Skywalker and an NCAA champion at NC State. And, you guys in Denver there in 75-76 put together a heck of a season. You won 60 games. And it should be noted that you guys won the All-Star game People say who won the All-Star game that year? Was it the East? Was it the West? No, it was the Denver Nuggets that won that All-Star game. And you guys, of course, went on and played Julius Erving in the Nets in the last ABA final series, and they took you guys in six games, and of course you played in the last ever ABA game. What are your memories coming out of that 76 season, and when did you realize that, okay, this long anticipated, much speculated about merger is actually going to happen now?
Yeah, and you know, we had our president and general manager at that time was a gentleman by the name of Carl Scheer, and Carl Scheer had been had worked in the NBA head office at one time, and he was pretty well connected, and he was a big part of that merger. But it was real interesting to hear all of the rumors and everything that was happening, and who was going to be involved, and how they decided what teams were going to be involved in the merger, and of course the four teams that went into the NBA paid a dear price. I mean, there was a big fee for joining, and no television money for a couple of years, and maybe not a first round draft pick the first year. And then the other teams, the other three teams that didn't go, of course, their players were dispersed, and Artis wound up with the Chicago Bulls, and Louis wound up with the San Antonio Spurs. But you know, we were pretty excited after years of kind of playing in a vacuum. You know, we were very excited here in Denver that we were going to have a chance to go as a team into the NBA.
And as you noted, you guys were successful right away, winning division championships. But as a guy who, to some degree, probably, I'm sure even right now, his heart, part of your heart at least, is in Kentucky. How did you feel about the Colonels franchise being folded? I believe John Y. Brown got $3 million to fold the team, and then, of course, wound up buying the Buffalo Braves. Did you think that Kentucky had a chance to be a part of the merger, or was it a situation where, you know, reading the cards, it seemed like Kentucky was going to be a candidate to be left out of the prize?
I think Ricky, that, you know, John Wine, I can't blame him for this. I mean, every time he had a chance to take some money off of the table, he did. And you know, he starting with selling me, and then dispersing in the players. But you know, as you said, then he went and bought an NBA franchise in Buffalo. But I believe in my heart of hearts that if we had been able to keep that team, that 1975 championship team together, had we kept that team together and that team had gone into the NBA, I think they would have been just as successful, if not more so, than we were here in Denver.
Are you at all surprised that in the 40 years since then that you know, I know that there's been a time or two when the franchises have been relocating, where Kentucky has tried to get into the mix. Are you at all surprised that Kentucky has never had a professional, you know, NBA team at all since then?
Yeah, and you know, my dear friend Bruce Miller, who was that attorney that I referenced earlier,
yes,
that represented me and wrote the letter to the Baltimore newspaper. Bruce has been, you know, for 30 years he's tried to get a team there, and he thought he was close when Charlotte went to New Orleans, and he thought he had a chance when Seattle went to Oklahoma City. I really do believe that that Louisville could support a team. Now, it'd have to be a good team. You know, it couldn't. At least at some point, you know, it couldn't be a team that won 30 games because they wouldn't be very supportive of that after the first couple of years. But I think they would support a team, and you know, I'd love to see the Kentucky Colonels playing again in the NBA. That'd be a real kick.
Yeah, that's my dream. Even though I live in Chicago now, I think I would definitely get back down to Louisville for a couple of games and see them when they come to town. Let me ask you just a question or two about the NBA, and then I really want to talk with you to wrap things up about the great work that you're doing with the Dropping Dimes Foundation. But those first seasons in the NBA. What, for you, were the differences that you noticed between, and you can take this question however you want, on the court, off the court, what were the differences that really struck you being a six-year ABA veteran who was getting your first taste of the way that things were done in this other league?
I think on the court, there wasn't a whole lot of difference. What I was really surprised about, because being in the ABA, you know, we all kind of thought we were underdogs, and we all had this mentality that it was us against the world, and you know, by the end of the ABA, there were so few teams, you know, it seemed like you were playing a team every week or two, and you really you had an opportunity to develop relationships with the other players, to know the other players, and we would go out, you know, you might go out with a couple guys from the other team to get something to eat after a game, and that lack of camaraderie, the lack of relationships between the teams in the NBA was really, really surprising. I mean, you didn't get to know anybody on the other teams. You barely spoke to anybody on the other team. And so that, I think, was what really hit me the most, the biggest difference between the ABA and the NBA.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense, because you guys, having such a relatively small league, it was almost like baseball in a sense. You would play these teams. You'd see them a lot of times during the regular season.
It seemed like we were on that bus to Indianapolis about once a week.
Well, speaking of the NBA and the ABA for that matter, just the grind of professional basketball. You are noted for your durability, and over the course of your 15-year career, I believe that you missed something like 24 games to injuries in 15 years. And as I was looking at your numbers today, I believe you missed 13 regular season games over your first 13 years in the league. So you were a real slacker, Dan, you know, setting out one game a year. Can you begin to explain to somebody who is not accustomed to that kind of environment the wear and tear of traveling around the country and playing 82 or 84 basketball games, as the case may have been?
Yeah, Ricky, I tell people I didn't run fast enough or jump high enough to get hurt. So that's why I didn't miss any games. You know, it was a different mentality. I mean, the money is so big now. I mean, you know, you can't blame these kids for, you know, if there's a question about their health or an injury, you know, they sit out for a week now, and you really can't blame them because the money is so big. I think my attitude was always, you know, if I sat out a game, I was you know, I wasn't being fair with my teammates, and I'm sure that there were plenty of games that I shouldn't have played, that I should have sat out. But for some reason, it seemed like whenever I had something bothering me or wasn't feeling well, I played better. And so, you know, I didn't want to let my teammates down, so I played, and I was lucky that I never had a major injury. I don't know that I ever, missed two games in a row. And as you said, with the schedule and playing as many games and traveling in between, I was very lucky not to.
So, Dan, talk to me a little bit, if you will, about the Dropping Dimes Foundation, because some while back I had Darnell Hillman on the podcast, and also Scott Tarter, the president of Dropping Dimes, joined us on that episode. And the work that's being done now for former ABA players by this organization is just terrific. And I know that yourself and a number of other former ABA stars are involved with this. Could you share for my audience what the Dropping Dimes Foundation is and what you guys are up to?
Yeah, Scott Tarter was the one who first contacted me, and he and a couple of his friends were huge ABA fans growing up, and they got to know some of those old Pacers. I talked about Bob Nedelicki a minute ago, and Darnell Hillman and Mel Daniels, God rest his soul, was very active until his passing. And they're getting other ABA players from other teams involved now, and it's basically Scott had heard some stories about former ABA players who were homeless and didn't have money to take care of their bills and started this foundation. And Dropping Dimes refers to an assist, and it's all about assisting former ABA players that are down on their luck. And one of the things we're able to help with some bills and dental work and health care and things like that. But I think one of the best things they've done, and not very many people knew, that there was ABA retirement money out there. And evidently this was a fund that had started and was being overseen by some people in San Antonio that were with the old Spurs club. And so they've been able, I know a couple of former players, teammates of mine, on that championship team that we talked about, that they've been able to go and it's not a lot of money, but it's $25,000, $30,000, $40,000 that they've been able to get for these guys out of this retirement fund that nobody even knew existed. And so it's a marvelous organization, and it's growing all the time. And I don't know what we'll do with it when all of us ABA players are dead, but right now it's really doing great work, and I have to commend the old Pacer team, Scott and his friends in the law office that are doing this, because we've been able to really help some people out that needed it.
That's absolutely terrific. Of course, you can go to their website. Dropping Dimes is on Twitter as well. If you Google that, you'll be able to find it. And certainly any donations from the public are welcome as well. Right, Dan?
Absolutely. If you remember the ABA and got any enjoyment out of watching that league and those players, anything you can do helps, that's for sure.
All right, Dan, I got to ask you before we go real quick, what do we have to do to get George McGinnis in the Hall of Fame?
That's an excellent question. And they had an ABA committee. The Hall of Fame wanted to make sure that nobody that had fallen through the cracks that from the ABA that deserved to be in it. And of course the first selection from the ABA committee was Artis Gilmore, who should have been, as George should have been in the Hall a long time ago. And then people like Mel Daniels and Roger Brown and Louis Dampier and Slick Leonard were all elected to the Hall of Fame by that ABA committee. But unfortunately, They no longer have the APA committee, so George will have to go to the veteran committee. And we, you know, they only put in one a year, and there's a lot of deserving people. But they used to say, you know, write a letter or have somebody, but the Hall of Fame has gotten so secretive of who's on those committees and how those players are chosen, it's very difficult. But I agree with you 100%. George McGinnis was a heck of a player, and he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame.
Dan Issel, you're a Hall of Famer, the collegiate legend at the University of Kentucky, and I think most of all, you're a good guy. I appreciate you so much coming on the podcast. You elevate the enterprise with your participation in this podcast. You make me look good, so I sure do appreciate you being my guest today.
Thank you, Ricky. I'd love to join you anytime.
All right. Thank you so much, my friend. You have a good one.
Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. Thanks, Dan.